Welcome to the 21st episode of Cartoon Avatars. I'm your host, Logan Bartlett, and I'm joined today by featured guest, recurring co-host Zach Weinberg, as well as John Wu. How are we doing today, guys?
Doing great. Thanks for having us, Logan.
Yeah, same.
I think Zach needs no introduction at this point. Zach, you're back from, how was the wedding?
It was great. I had a blast. We had 3 days. We were actually in Budapest. Now that I'm not there, I can reveal where I was, I guess. Although in a funny twist, I have another wedding next week, which you know about. So I will be gone again for another 5 days or 4 days, but hopefully this is over very soon.
You got to get ahead of not saying the location of where you're traveling to, particularly because we don't know how these clips are going to go viral on TikTok.
Yeah, I don't want that private jet tracker on me either, you know, because if they ever look up a United Airlines tail number, they'll know exactly where I am.
Well, I'm here to make the peace between you and the crypto community. That's why I'm here, right?
That's what you came with, peace offerings. Yeah, association with Zach Weinberg these days. Yeah,
this is my emissary I've sent out into the community. It's great. I appreciate it, John. Thank you.
Yeah, excited.
Well, John, so Brandon Reeves from Lux made the introduction over the weekend, and it's funny, we've gotten a lot of people like raising their hand, wanting to come forward and discuss crypto with I guess us, but specifically Zach. And so then I saw your thread on Celsius, and it made me remember. I'd actually come across your Twitter profile a few times, kind of distilling down things that I only barely understood, and at least leaving with a little bit better of an understanding. And so you've done a great job of doing that. So maybe just give a little bit of background for people listening in terms of what your day job is outside of Twitter thread posting, and then we can go from there.
Yeah, so my day job includes Twitter thread posting. I'm head of growth at Aztec Network, which is a privacy-first ZK rollup on Ethereum. In English words, we're a privacy layer for Web3. And so a lot of the problems with Web3 right now are full transparency, you know, lack of privacy, high execution costs. We try to solve all those things on the Ethereum network.
Okay, cool. And Ethereum, for folks that don't know, is the second most valuable, I guess, cryptocurrency out there currently. A lot of the stuff that you do with NFTs or DeFi, a lot of that stuff is enabled through Ethereum. So
I was actually just curious what you did before this, like how you got into it.
Yeah. So let's see. My background originally, I was a philosophy major in undergrad. My joke is I still ended up a management consultant. I did that for a couple of years. I did large cap private equity for a couple of years. I went to Harvard Business School for a couple of years. So I was like a full on capital S suit. After that, I did some startups in the real world, quote unquote. So I did a real estate startup. I did a food tech startup. I launched that food tech startup into 2020 and COVID. So we slammed right into a brick wall. When I was returning capital to investors in February 2021, I started getting into crypto. Now, I had always been a crypto skeptic. I didn't really understand it. I bought and sold Bitcoin at a loss in 2013. I'm sure many of the listeners on this podcast have a story like that. And actually what got me into it was a couple buddies of mine were like, hey, you should check out what's happening in DeFi, decentralized finance. You're a TradFi, you know, traditional finance guy. Go check it out. I started looking at Uniswap, which is a permissionless exchange, a decentralized exchange. I was immediately blown away by how it was designed and the potential that it had. I was lucky enough to actually spend about a month working for Uniswap in a partnerships capacity. And then after that, I just kind of was so deep in the rabbit hole. I was like, I want to go to the frontier. I want to go to do the craziest thing crypto people can conceive of right now. And that is in the space zero knowledge technology. So zero knowledge is a new form of encryption and cryptographic proving that really was invented in large part by our team. Zach Williamson and Ariel Gavazan invented essentially the most efficient ZK SNARK encryption architecture that's used by the industry today. So yeah, all those are gibberish words if you don't know anything about blockchain, but the long and short of it is I decided to go to the most extreme, most groundbreaking part of the industry.
John, I'm going to cut you off there. Why don't we broaden the aperture a little bit and talk about a little bit more of the general stuff going on in the crypto world?
Yeah, so I think it's worth doing a quick run through of how Ethereum works. I'll do it in less than a minute. I've done it a ton. So the way Ethereum works is it's distributed compute. Okay, we basically say to everyone, There's state A, which is, you know, Logan's got an ETH balance, Zach does, and I do. And then there's a set of transactions called a block that then gets executed on top of that current state. And then the state deterministically changes to the next state. And so all of our account balances get updated. That's the way to think about it. And all the Ethereum nodes, they propagate this computation and they all double check each other. And so there's a lot of, I think Ethereum is an incredible innovation, truly one of the most amazing things that ever been built. Why is the world computer so cool, so interesting, so innovative? Number one, it's decentralized, so I don't have to trust any one person, right? Number two, it's 100% uptime. I've got like 100 nodes out here. They're all propagating the same information. And three, it's trustless and verifiable. I can, if I run my own node, I can see that the computation is correct. I don't have to trust anyone.
There's obviously been a bunch of stuff going on in the ecosystem today, but maybe just give us a level setting of, in talking to you before this and what I've been told. I mean, you come from a fairly rational perspective of, I think, bridging this gap between the crypto community and the skeptics community, at least in the conversations with you before this. And so maybe just level set us on, like, what do you believe is going on right now? Where do you think that there is going to be opportunity? What are we going to care about in 5-10 years? What's the current state and the future state of all this mania we're kind of seeing play out in real time?
Yeah, there's a lot of ways we could talk about this, but I think probably what your listeners are going to care most about is, you know, what's going on with the markets, right? And it's some unholy combination of 2008, which is like a giant deleveraging event, and 2000, which is the popping of a speculative bubble. That's obviously what's happening here. Now, we could argue about, you know, what the mix of is these characters, but you know, look at what's happening with Celsius. Celsius can be analogized for those traditional finance veterans from 2008 with the collapse of MF Global, which was a broker dealer. Basically, you know, they told clients they were investing in safe instruments and instead they were doing some stupid ass speculative stuff. You can look at Three Arrows Capital, which is rumored to be insolvent today, as kind of a blow up of Archegos, that hedge fund that blew up because they were going to their prime brokers and saying, hey, you know, we're only taking leverage from you. But instead, in the background, they're taking leverage from everyone. And all of this unsecured lending kind of blew up in Nomura's face. It blew up in Credit Suisse's face. It really affected these giant international banks, just one guy being overlevered. And so I would say right now what we're seeing because of the macro pressure, and by macro, I mean like public equities, I mean the interest rate environment. We're just seeing a reset in crypto valuations that's washing out a bunch of the capital and leverage from the system.
But John, I was told it was an inflation hedge.
Yeah, I as a marketer, I'm a marketer, right? Ultimately speaking, I'm a marketer, right? That is my day job. The inflation hedge thing is it's a narrative. It's a narrative. And ultimately, guess what? Guess who decides whether it is an inflation hedge or not? The market does. And the market has decided this shit's really fucking correlated to tech stocks. It's really correlated to tech. And so actually, and I think there's some really smart voices around the room, including those who are inside the crypto space. Chris Berniski from Placeholder, I think, is a really great voice on some of these things. You know, it looks like some of the original theses behind Bitcoin don't seem as valid anymore, right? And in 2013, 2012, 2011, Bitcoin was a contrarian bet. It was super uncorrelated to anything. It was a small number of nerds. And on any basis, risk-adjusted, inflation-adjusted, whatever, it was a great investment. Now, there's almost nobody on Earth who's not aware of what crypto is, right? And so Bitcoin's highly correlated tech. Ethereum's highly correlated tech. So now you got to look at it with much more rationality, with a much more critical eye. You can't take some of these like old narratives and parrot them back again. You have to think about how do these things become sustainable businesses? How do these things have a place in our world? And that's why I think, Zach, you know, voices like yours, as rough as it is to get taken to the woodshed, like Mike Dudas and Baggy did in some, you know, some small part. It's important to have critical voices to test the industry on, like, are you guys building real shit and creating real value for the world, or are you not?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, actually, Logan, I don't know if I even told you this. I don't remember who we were talking. I think it was Dudas. We were talking about Bitcoin as like a inflation hedge or lack thereof. And I think I said something along the lines of like, it's correlated with the NASDAQ and it's not correlated with gold. And one of my best friends in finance texted me and he's like, I can't believe your Bitcoin take. It's all wrong. And I said, what do you mean? He said, Well, it's actually negatively correlated with gold. And I hadn't realized that. It actually moves in the opposite direction of gold. So it's not only not an inflation hedge, it's like a negative hedge, which I thought was really interesting. There's always like the finance person behind me who's telling me that I'm wrong in some way. Because like, I think I understand the financial markets and I know maybe like more than I should, but not enough to actually be an expert. So anyway, I appreciate your natural skepticism.
Yeah, John, maybe, I mean, it's one thing for us to shoot spitballs a little bit or, you know, be smart asses in my case and in Zach's case, you know, really push questioning on all this. What got you at the point of time? Obviously, it was much more speculative and the Bitcoin prices were running up over the course of the last 2 years. But what was the unlock for you to say, hey, you know what? I've had this traditional, I've operated in these different industries before, and I'm going to go all in and actually bet my career on this. What was the unlock that you saw, either from a opportunity set standpoint, use cases? Like, what was it that really got you as a smart, thoughtful person to dive headfirst into this?
You know, in reality, it was Uniswap. So if you're not familiar with Uniswap, it's a decentralized exchange. And what that means is the original version of Uniswap was like 20 lines of code. And it's built around this constant function formula that's X times Y equals K. We don't need to get into technically what that means. All that you need to know about Uniswap is that this formula deterministically executes trades on your behalf. So anybody can market make for this exchange by just putting dollars in, and anyone can trade on this exchange by essentially interacting with a smart contract and having their trade be deterministically executed by X times Y equals K. Okay, so why is this like a crazy idea? Because if you're familiar with traditional markets, you need many players, right? You need the exchange to like match orders. You need an order book system. You need market makers to come in and provide liquidity. You need traders. You need, even in our traditional markets, there are human-controlled circuit breakers. There are times when humans step in and intervene. So there's like all of this coordination, like human friction that happens in a conventional market. So when I saw Uniswap for the first time, which is like I click this button and the order deterministically executes. So I know exactly what the execution price is. The market knows exactly what the price is going to be after my trade. That was kind of an insane idea to me that like, you know, we use this term, you know, in the crypto space, atomic. Atomic means kind of irreducible, right? The fact that a trade could be irreducible, not dependent on any other action, but like an atomic trade, like it's for sure going to happen and it's for sure going to happen in this exact way. Well, now you can build all kinds of like crazy products on top of it. By the way, not all great products, but imagine if you could swap anything for anything at any time. And because crypto is, we'll talk about this, but it's built on Ethereum, which is a 100% uptime network, right? It's built on 100% uptime and it runs 24/7 a day. You can swap any crypto asset for any other crypto asset at any time. So now let's say I want to do a pretty complex financial transaction that includes a loan or includes, you know, provisioning funds to, you know, a yield vault or really anything that you might do in DeFi. Well, if having to swap asset A for asset B is a necessary part of building whatever you want to build, you know for sure, you can call a Uniswap function and it will 100% deterministically execute. Now let's compare this to like Web 2. Web 2 is moving to a universe of open APIs, right? We were in a closed, Web 1 was in a closed ecosystem for a long time. It really was just siloed information. You go to pets.com and like you see some pet goods. You go to, you know, AskJeeves.com, you get a search engine, whatever. That was Web 1.0, right? Web 2 was about mobile and it was about open APIs. Now, these backend databases can talk to one another. Now I can call data down, you know, from an open API from that. If I want to integrate with another service, I just have to ping their API, their endpoint, and I can pull data in. Web 3 is basically just leaping ahead and saying, it's by default open. You don't need an API key. It's not asynchronous execution. It's not maybe the API call completes, maybe it doesn't. It's deterministic synchronous execution. So if I'm doing a trade, it for sure 100% is going to happen. That's really what was crazy about it to me.
And Uniswap, just to make sure, because I think sometimes it can get confusing for people, it's the ability to like deterministically swap purely digital asset. I think you said essentially one crypto asset for another. That's kind of the primary use case.
100%.
Yeah, I almost look at it as like the most like pure form of like libertarian trading, if you will.
Yep.
Where you just like, you're on your own. And if you make a mistake, that's on you. And it is like the end of the spectrum, if you will, in terms of lack of any sort of protections. And it works. Like, it clearly works. You can swap A for B, and then it's up to you to make sure you want to do that correctly. Is that kind of fair?
That's
to say?
Exactly right. And that's why I'm not going to stand here and I'm not going to make excuses about, oh, you can't revert transactions. To me, that's a feature, not a bug. To me, not having a middleman is a feature, not a bug. And so when people try to fight back against stuff like that, I'm like, we have to lean into what makes crypto great, not apologize for, you know, the differences that it has to the real world. And this is another thing I'll add. And I remember hearing your packy conversation about mortgages on blockchain. I used to be a real estate guy, okay? I have suffered a lot of pain. I have watched crackheads break into my house. I know how tough real world businesses are. Let me just say definitively, this is one man's opinion, but I feel very strongly about it. You're never, ever going to bridge real world assets and businesses on chain. This is something called the Oracle problem. The Oracle problem basically says you're building a decentralized environment, right? It's trustless. It's permissionless. Now, all of a sudden I say, I want to bring a mortgage on chain, or, you know, I want to bring a real world financial instrument on chain, or I want to bring Zach's passport on chain, right? Okay. How do I get that information on chain? By definition, one person, a regulated authority, has to do that. The bank, also in real estate, the freaking municipal title, right?
Or like the data entry person who has to type it in. Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah. There's some woman who's deeply underpaid and unsatisfied with her life sitting at City Hall. And you're going to trust that person to get your mortgage information, your title information, all the real world info on chain. Okay. All of a sudden, we just took the greatest thing about crypto, which is decentralized, it's trustless, it's permissionless, there's no single point of failure, and we dropped it all into this woman's lap. Lara at City Hall is now got the whole burden of making sure the information is accurate in her lap. Okay, well, haven't we kind of lost the plot there if we're going to constrain everything and bottleneck it through this one person?
Logan, yeah. How are we supposed to fight? I think I'm falling in love with John. In my crypto notes, it literally has the Oracle like this. I have had this conversation with multiple people. I mean, you just nailed it. That's exactly right. I wish I had something else to say besides you're right.
So, John, I guess my question in this is so to what end, right? Of all of these use cases, like I think we're in agreement with what you're saying about all this stuff, but. But to what end do you think that this matters, right? Because I think we agree that all this stuff can exist online and in a digital form. But to some extent, aren't we all just propping up speculation if there's not like a concrete use case that actually does matter in the real world? Even if it's not actually of the real world, it needs to impact the real world and not just, you know, bits moving on screen.
And I would ask even like specific, because I think you have clearly a very rational perspective on this. And like, I couldn't agree more. Like the real world bridge into the digital is not a feature that will not happen in any way. So clearly when you narrow the scope there, yeah, what are you excited about? What's like top 2, 3? I mean, obviously you work for a company that does something here, so I'm guessing that's in the top 3.
Yeah, well, there's a lot. I think we're touching on a lot of stuff here, so I want to break down, you know, a couple components of it, right? The first is like we talk about the speculative bubble. You know, the speculation piece is an early use case. Let's not kid ourselves about that either. We've built the world's best casino. It's like unregulated. Anyone can make money. It's positive sum because there's more people coming into it. And so like, it's really distracting to look at the speculative case and say, oh boy, it's useful for nothing. But I would make, you know, maybe a controversial claim to be like, it is actually useful. Gambling is an industry, right? It's like speculation is fun. Like, and in a positive sum environment, like that's a thing. But people fixate too much on the speculation and they fail to see the transformative infrastructure that's being built. Similarly, like if we went back to the 1990s and we looked at TCP/IP, and you talk to an internet skeptic and you were like, and he was like, well, what can you do on the internet? And I'm like, not very much. Like there's this like Usenet group that I'm in. And like, we talk about like our cats and stuff. And he's like, oh, it seems like a scam. But you would have ignored that there is this underlying infrastructure that was better than what it was replacing, right? Like fax.
I don't know if that's how that meeting went. I think someone was like, hey, I get to send a message to somebody on the other side of the world with my computer. And by the way, I don't need to use the mailman. That feels like pretty compelling. I agree. You maybe not like you wouldn't have predicted the current use cases, but at least the basics were like pretty cool, you know?
Wasn't it porn? Was the, I mean, it feels like that's actually crypto's big problem is it doesn't have porn evangelizing it the way that that the internet did.
It's very true.
But no, I mean, Bezos felt like, at least you could get your head around, hey, there's infinite access to books, right? And like the problem with shelf space that occurs in retail stores. Sure, there's a ton of logistical challenges with it, but I could at least get my head around, and maybe I'm using hindsight bias on this, but, you know, there was that stuff going on. And so I guess what is the use case that that you can imagine or that you can articulate other than the hand waving?
Yeah, post-speculation. I agree with you. Speculation in this setup is a feature in the sense that it drives kind of like people to the chain, if you will, very quickly because of the speculative nature of it. At some point, obviously, that dies down and ends. And then it's the like, and now what? And that's kind of what we're curious about, I think.
Right. And I think what's tough about crypto is because we purport to be a financial innovation, it just feels really technical and not useful to an individual. But to businesses and to institutions, I actually think it's really valuable. And so if I think about Uniswap, for example, right, and I'll keep going to financial use cases where it's like instant settlement, deterministic settlement. Like the other day, I wrote an angel check to a company in the crypto space, and I sent it via bank wire. And then five days after I sent the wire, they called me and they're like, hey, your wire has been canceled due to fraud. And I'm like, okay, well, can you get me back in my account? And I spent an hour getting back on. I had to get them to like, you redo the entire wire. So for businesses who understand how much friction there is to transact financially, right? There's just the basic payments. Like think about wire, right? You just think about basic payments. That's just far superior. The simplest use case is by far the best. But then there's all these much...
But that's just not like, I mean, we don't have to go into this and have that same argument again, but like I would argue that is by no means superior because by the way, like part of the reason why those financial transactions take a while is you have to do money laundering checks. You have to make sure the people on the other side aren't on like some terrorist watch list. By the way, to keep you out of jail primarily, you have an ability to like make fixes if something goes wrong, if you get scammed, if they get scammed. I agree in this like purely libertarian world where like you make a mistake, like good luck. But that I don't think is the vast majority or even like a tiny little minority of what people really want. Like who really wants that? I take on unlimited risk in case anything possibly goes wrong, including the risk of like possibly going to jail if I send the money to someone in the, you know, Iranian National Guard or something along that. You know what I mean? Like that seems risky to me.
No, I think this is the fun part. The fun part is not us sitting in this room speculating about what will or won't happen, but the state of the world 10 or 20 or 30 years from now when we see whether there's true adoption. And so a lot of the reason why crypto was invented was as an insurance policy against centralized forces. So if you don't believe, if you're not on some level cynical about the way the world is going, that you don't see a certain amount of like corruption in data oligopolies like Google and Facebook and Microsoft, that you don't see that the federal government is implementing more and more controls on individual liberties. Like, again, I'm not saying I'm like a capital L, you know, extreme libertarian, but you have to have a belief that number one, more and more security issues are going to happen, right? There's going to be more and more restrictions on your financial freedoms. And number two, that more and more of our lives are going to go onto digital rails. So like, part of, I think, the frustration of people when we talk about use cases is I kind of immediately go to like, yeah, we are actually going to eventually live in the metaverse. You already spend a huge amount of your time online, a huge amount of what you care about, your loved ones, your career, your output, like think about GitHub, your financial activity, the things that you purchase are already happening on digital rails. I'm not saying metaverse, like you're going to like put on some freaking VR goggles and you're going to become a lizard. I'm saying that our lives are going online. And so crypto is just a way to say, when you get to that state and your lives are online, they will not be controlled by central entities.
But that's the part that I just think isn't true. And it depends on who you define as like central entity, because I do think we have to distinguish between a government, which has power and authority and guns, which is very different from a Google and a Facebook, which obviously are subject to like regulations and laws. And I think sometimes for whatever reason in the discussion, people seem to conflate these two things because they're just like big and like, we don't like them because they're big for some reason.
Yep.
The government one, let's leave Google and Facebook aside for one second.
Sure.
The government one doesn't hold any weight, in my opinion, because ultimately you still live in a country, whether it's the United States or we talked about Iran in the previous one, or maybe you live in Venezuela, wherever it may be, where you are ultimately, and the businesses you interact with are ultimately subject to those local rules or lack thereof, and as a result, the local military. And so I always struggle with like, okay, at some point, I need to turn this digital thing I own into fiat, right? I have to like actually use my local currency in some way, or I have to interact with a business in my local country who needs to eventually get to local fiat. And that's where the government immediately can step in because they can always show up with their guns. So I just never understood like how this trustless, permissionless money actually plays out in the specifically in the government use case. So we can leave the Googles aside for a second. Like, can't they always just show up and take it from you?
So, I mean, it depends on how extremist you want to get. But there's this book, Sovereign Individual, which looks very cynically at a long-term vision of individuals like the founder of Uniswap, Hayden Adams is a good example, who can write 25 lines of code and create billions of dollars of value, going and shopping around the world for governments who are willing to offer them protection for some rate, right? And so it is a technology that arms individuals for greater negotiating power over extractive sovereigns. And so if you don't believe in that, if you don't think there will be a huge amount of production by essentially like a small, you know, techno, crypto, you know, these folks who create tons of value on digital rails, if you don't think it's important that that happens, if you don't think, if you're not one of those people, then you might be like, this doesn't affect me. And you may well be right.
I don't think like really smart people who are trying to make tons of money are going to be like, in order for me to do this, I have to move to like the middle of Micronesia where the government has recruited me by saying, promise us, or I'm promising you we're not going to show up with guns.
But it's already happening, right? It's already happening. People are already shopping. How many of your friends have moved to Miami or Austin? You think they just did it for the weather? No, they're shopping for regimes where they pay a lower tax rate. Now, I know that sounds like,
yeah, but that
really
has nothing to do with, that has nothing to do with like permissionless money. Like, yeah, they go for lower tax rate on their dollars. Not like, this isn't like they can go show up in Bitcoin and start spending Bitcoin without the US government having controls over it. It just doesn't work.
Okay, but that's not actually, let's think about what Bitcoin offers you, right? Think about capital controls. I spent a year and a half of my life in China. And China as a sovereign, they're very savvy. They're like, once you create value here, you ain't leaving. We're keeping a lot between these four walls. So think about Bitcoin in that case, where I can hold a pointer to an online address, which is on a USB key, it's on a ledger, or it's on a hardware wallet. And now that capital comes with me, right? My net worth, wherever it is, it's first of all, 100% uptime. I can carry that to wherever I want to go.
If you flee the country, this is the one use case I actually do agree with you on, which is like in the sovereign money or lack thereof, I guess, which is in the 48 hours in which you want to leave this country and get out, and by the way, never come back, because you come back and it's not going to be a good situation. You can put as much Bitcoin as you possibly can get, which is another issue of like, how do you get it in the first place, given you're probably paid sovereignly. But yes, if you have exclusively digital assets and you want to flee the country in 48 hours, yeah, 100%. Bitcoin's pretty good. The alternative these days is essentially like diamonds. Right. Like the most concentrated form of wealth pre-Bitcoin is basically a diamond. Beyond that, like flee the country, China and others have quite a bit of control. And I think this is like one of these false assumptions that people make, which is, well, if I'm like an independent citizen, like I'm not subject to the rules. China, the best example, I actually think, is them, which is back in early 2021, I think it was. They basically banned Bitcoin mining. They're just like, yep. No more Bitcoin mining.
Yep.
Which they obviously can't actually control necessarily, like from a technical perspective, but they can do it from a legal perspective.
Yes.
And what is the current mining business in China? I think it's zero, right?
Yeah, it's zero.
Yeah. So like, there's your best example of like where the limitations are. But yes, like flee the country, take your money. I'm with you there.
John, do you think one of the, and maybe now I don't actually have to read this book now that you gave me a quick synopsis on it, but like, do you think there's a tension in all of this that exists between, we talked about it before, but immoral versus illegal, and that we're increasingly going to just, in this libertarian world that we're, that we're talking about here, and we could say how far along that extent, but is this people kind of arbitrarily deciding like, hey, these are, you know, these are the things I agree with, and here's the things I don't, and I don't want to be governed by the laws of, like, doesn't this go to some logical extreme position that feels very impractical to the countries and the states that we live in?
That may well be the case, right? And it's like, let's think about the Bitcoin origin story. It's a crypto anarchist story. It's a story about deep mistrust of conventional institutions. And so we actually find ourselves in this really bizarre place where this industry that's built really by the long tail of users, people who have extreme views on individual freedoms, you know, anti-sovereign, you know, anti-centralization, that technology is now being used to like sell ape pictures to like millions of people. And so I think that's some of the cognitive dissonance that you're seeing in the space, right? You're like, hold on, this technology is like really about rejecting some of these like norms, right? It's like almost by definition, like not going to be a mass adoption technology. Like if you take something as deep and as original as like as pure as Bitcoin, right? It's like it almost seems like that's the type of person it speaks to. On the other hand, we want the number to go up, right? Crypto holders have economic incentives too. And so we've found ourselves in this like perverse world where we're taking a highly libertarian technology that is based on financial autonomy, financial freedom, and we're trying to give it to everyone. And so when you say, hey, this seems kind of inconvenient for most people, so be it. So be it. If you don't actually want to hold your keys, if you don't actually want to hold the USB key and put it in a safe under your bed, because that's what you have to do,
yeah,
then you shouldn't be involved. And that's what I want to really beat people over the head with. We were supposed to come on and talk about Celsius. Are we ready to talk about Celsius?
Well, no,
you don't think Satoshi was like, I just think like, I'm just imagining Satoshi being like, I want to create this trustless society around crypto. And then they're like, and also I really want Andreessen Horowitz to raise a $4.5 billion crypto fund from LPs.
I mean, that's the joke, right? And sorry, it's hard being in the industry because you want both. You know, I'm not going to lie. I wanted to get big. I wanted to get mass adoption.
Anything has weird bedfellows. Like if you look at the Republican Party and the Democratic Party today, like there's very convenient bedfellows that are comprised of like, you know, any group of people, right? And it's like the religious right with the economic libertarians,
right?
And you know, one does not give a shit about the other one cares about, but it's like, hey, we're in bed together, let's do it. Right. And so,
right. There's this like horseshoe. Yes.
John, one question for you on this one. And going back to Celsius, sorry, Logan, was like, which I think is really interesting. So obviously, like, lack of consumer protections is in your head a feature here, and that's part of what's happening, right? There's no rules, and things blow up, and ultimately they blow up for retail at the end of it, who have made their own choices, to be very clear, right? Like, nobody said you must buy, you did. Like, how do you square the freedoms, if you will, with essentially what's happening now with Celsius? And we should hear your take on what's going on, where, you know, normal people are going to lose quite a bit of money as these things collapse.
And maybe, John, level set the history of Celsius, the guy, the business, the funding, the tokens, the, you know, all that stuff for people.
Yeah. So I'm not going to get into, you know, putting a, you know, hit piece or hit segment out on Alex Mashinsky and the executive team there. And, you know, there's all these ad hominems about their backgrounds and the CFO went to prison and blah, 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 all the sordid past. I'm here.
I'm just going to clip that part, by the way, you saying the CFO went to prison, and I'm going to post that alone. Like, we'll clip everything else together.
I'm not going to say anything bad about them, but did you know the CFO went to prison? but I do want to talk about what Celsius was and purported to be, right? It purported to be a wrapper for DeFi. Like, hey, DeFi is really complicated. They did exactly what you're saying, Logan. They were like, you know what's really a pain in the dick is getting a USB key and keeping it on your bed and having to remember all these seed phrases, and you got to put it on like a steel because in case your house burns down, you need to recover it. And like, oh man, what a pain. How about you just download our iPhone app? How about that? And people were like, oh, that's amazing. And they're like, and if you download our iPhone app, you can still buy the digital coins And you know that the digital coins make you rich, right? All your friends are rich on the digital coins. You got to buy the digital coins. Do it through us. And people are like, this is amazing. Okay, so then what do? They have a website and they say, here's a bunch of DeFi yields, right? Okay, you can earn on your crypto. That was their primary product. Really, they had a couple things. They had borrow, which is commit your crypto in order to borrow funds, so leverage trading. The second is earn, which is put your crypto with us and you'll make a yield on it. And the third was just plain custody. Just give us your funds and like, we'll hold on to them for you, okay? Okay, so what did they do with customer funds once they got this?
Basically, we've made this joke in the past of how the smartest and dumbest people are in crypto, but they're basically taking the smartest people that know how to do all this stuff and saying, how do we bridge the gap to everyone else to have access to these things, right?
Yes. So maybe I'll rewind a tiny bit. Why does DeFi work? Why do I believe in it? Why, despite all the hacks and the degeneracy and the overleverage, why do I believe in it? Because it's an open financial system. Matt Levine at Bloomberg, the GOAT, by the way, is really, really fond of saying DeFi is learning in 2 years what it took the traditional finance industry 1,000 years to learn. So you got all these engineers who are building truly, truly innovative, permissionless exchanges, money markets, derivatives protocols. And these are folks looking at financial products with fresh eyes. They have no PTSD from having to call an OTC desk at JP Morgan and beg to get an order filled. They're just like, I write code and finance isn't that hard. You know, finance really is not that complicated. It's just a bunch of really simple formulas. And so why does DeFi work? Because it's open. Because every mistake and hack and security flaw that exists makes the industry better. It's all open source. So all developers look at the vulnerabilities and improve consistently. And most importantly of all, and this is where we might vary in terms of our expectations of the average intelligence of a human being. You can go look at the code. You can audit the code. You can read the contract. And in the original version of Uniswap, you could read a 25-line contract and you could say, you know, they're doing X, Y, and Z, and it looks pretty safe. And if you don't really feel that way, then there's a whole community of smart contract white hats, auditors, and critically, black hat hackers who are testing the security of the system constantly. There's a gigantic economic incentive to steal money from DeFi all the time. When I see a DeFi hack, I think that's one of the best things that happens to the space. What is that? The funds that are lost? That's an investment in security.
Like my brain is, I'm just laughing because I'm like, you just described the worst financial system ever created, but you spin it as the best, most open financial system ever created. And I'm really struggling to like square those two concepts together.
Look, and I think the part of the reason that it's so bad is because the people are really inexperienced, right? We're rebuilding on, there's double inexperience happening. Number one, the technology is super young, okay? Super young. And so there's lots of vulnerability with the technology. The second is the people who are building it are approaching it from first principles. They are not coming like me from Wall Street. They are not coming from 20 years, you know, being the head of institutional credit at some gigantic Wall Street firm. They don't have experience seeing the blow up case. So right now we're seeing a huge unwinding. This is a learning occasion for the DeFi community, the same way 2008 was a learning community for the Fed and for the U.S. government, and you know,
they're going to see every fraud that's ever happened in the last 100 years will be recreated. I totally agree. To what end, right? Like, why do we want to be here and lose whatever $50 billion, $100 billion, or however much is going to happen over the next few years? Because there are no rules, and you do have to read the code. And even if you read the code, you can still get scammed because of security issues on both ends of the spectrum, like sender and receiver, and all these fun little places. Plus, anytime you try and like hop into the real world, as you yourself described, you run into this like Oracle challenge of, well, somebody's keying in the data. Like, why do we care? What are we aiming for? What problem are we solving?
I think the people in the industry would say we genuinely believe there's a lower friction way of doing business. Now,
what does that mean? What is doing business? Like starting a company, like selling goods to people? Like, what does that mean?
Sending value, right? Sending value, creating systems that adjudicate value, create markets, create contracts. Let's say you and I want to make a commitment to each other, even something as simple as an employment contract. It can be deterministically enforced on chain. That can be
determinants, leak force. I mean, do we really want to open that can of worms of like how much you have to predefine every single thing in an employment contract?
Again, Zach, let me
give you an example, John. Yeah, I'm like, please. All right, in your employment contracts, John, you need to come paint my house blue. I don't know. I'm going to pay you $1 million.
I'm not trying to do that on change. But let me tell you an example that sounds like a toy. And this is where our views of the future universe are going to have to diverge. By definition, they're going to have to diverge. Someday, you're going to own a fucking rare car in the metaverse, and you're not going to make your payment on it, and they're not going to have to send a repo guy because it'll deterministically be repossessed. Now, you're like, oh, well, that's a crazy future. It'll never happen. Okay, it may not ever happen, right? But that's the bet I'm making. And so anyone,
the digital good in the digital world that I want to digitally own.
It, by definition, has to all be digital. It cannot touch the real world, by definition.
Yeah, the digital good argument. My question on that one, which has always been less about like crypto and more about incentives,
sure,
is at some point there's a creator of that game, right? And there's a reason why I want to own that digital car, and it's because the person who made the game that made the digital car interesting or useful or cool to look at or whatever. And those games are really complicated, right? If you look at like how much money typically goes into making a successful game these days, it's in the tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, right? Why is that game creator going to allow me to transfer my digital goods between games as opposed to what I think will likely happen? Is they just have their own digital goods infrastructure within the four walls of their own IP. Like, why is the blockchain involved here in any way? Not because it can't be. I agree it can be. Like, technically it can be. But why would the game creator, the actual person who cares about this, in the who made it in the first place, like, why are they going to open it up? Isn't the history of this basically like consolidation of IP? And that's why we have Disney and Marvel and, you know.
Yeah, I think you're making a straw man here because you have some friend who's like, oh, you know what's going to be really cool? I can buy a sword in game A and bring it to game B. Like, sorry, but I don't believe that. So you're setting up a straw man for...
All right, no, fair enough. Let's throw that one out.
I just don't believe that's true.
But then what was the digital car use case you were talking about? Walk me through that.
Yeah, so what I'm saying is this is a digital game asset, right? That can be sold on a permissionless market. That can be financed instantaneously. That can have a derivative against it. It can be insured permissionlessly. That insurance, if it hits, can be paid out automatically. Like, there's all these things that, like, take all of that friction in the real world. It's the same thing, but for a digital good.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're not wrong from a technical perspective. I guess my question is, like, why does the game owner want that?
I guess I have a harder time understanding why removing all the human adjudication and friction from our world doesn't make systems more efficient and predictable, right?
Why is the game owner trying to make the system more efficient and predictable? Aren't they essentially trying to like tax the transactions because they really are a for-profit entity? Like, I guess aren't their goals as the game owner slightly not the same thing as the underlying like users who want to do this? Like, and they control it too, right? They ultimately control it.
So this is the real question with decentralization, right? Which is who is the owner? And this is why we'll have to loop back to Celsius eventually. This is why stuff like Celsius is particularly dangerous, because it is actually centralized. But in most crypto protocols, the ownership is actually decentralized and in the hands of the users. So the users get to vote in their own best interest. Now, the economic model, I don't think we have time on this podcast to explain, because it doesn't look like EBITDA. It looks completely different. Like, tokenomic models look completely different than conventional earnings. But
that's because they look like Ponzi schemes. That's why.
We'll have to take that to another cast.
There's no actual earnings. They're just like, hey, if more people buy this, the price goes up on this unproductive asset.
We'll have to take that to another cast, but there are definitely, now this is the catch-22 with crypto. The tokens that look like they have earnings also look like securities, and all of a sudden you're in territory where you can't really actually, do that, right?
Yeah.
My
whole take on that, the digital goods in the digital game thing, I agree with you. If we're going to isolate like an interesting area where, and you said this best, it's like purely digital end to end, right? There's no crossover into the universe, I think is right. The finance one, where you're doing this outside of the context of a game and you're moving into like real life where you need money to spend and buy things like, electricity and whatnot. This whole thing
Why does that have to be the case? You have some share of wallet. Let's say your share of wallet is 100% real world, right? You only buy sandwiches with real fiat dollars and cash. Right. Okay, you can imagine some amount of the economy is going to go purely digital. It's not 100%. Anyone who says Web3 is going to replace Web2, Web3 is going to be 100% of our lives, any of that is just bunk, right? Like, it's obviously true we're not going to let go of atoms. But you can imagine 5% of your money, you have a little pool of money on the side, and it's ETH, right? And you do that, and you have a digital life over here, and you play a game, and it's like the blockchain version of Second Life, and you really like this game, and there's a little in-game economy, and there's assets in it, and you transfer it, and there's an in-game stock market, and there's an in-game money market, and there's in-game lending, and there's in-game insurance. And it's like, okay, that's not actually that hard to imagine. What's hard to imagine?
Don't we have that stuff for now? Like, don't you have in-game currencies and in-game marketplaces and in-game trading in some of the biggest games? Now, I agree it's not on the blockchain and it's not decentralized, but doesn't the use case kind of exist already?
Okay, it's for sure. And that's for sure it exists. And that's why we need to be really clear about the benefits of blockchain, right? The whole benefit, the whole reason is so that stuff like Celsius shouldn't be able to happen. And every time it does, that's why people get really upset at me for highlighting stuff like this. Because it looks bad for crypto, but it's not bad for crypto. We need to flush out anyone who's pretending to be decentralized, but they're not.
John, can you, now, this is a good point. This is a good time to, like, give us the, I cut you off halfway through. Give us the Celsius, like, the state of play of what happened, where we are, and all of that now.
Yeah, so they took a bunch of user deposits, and they said, look, we'll invest these deposits on your behalf. So this is like an MF Global broker-dealer situation where, you know, you don't know what they're doing with your assets. You have to trust. I want you to take that word away today. Trust. You have to trust without being able to verify, because it's not actually blockchain. It's actually just an iPhone app and a bunch of human custodians and investment managers investing those funds on your behalf. Now, it turns out they did something that was like pretty silly. Okay. They took a bunch of ETH and they put it in the Beacon Chain. The Beacon Chain is essentially Ethereum's proof of stake chain. There are currently two Ethereum chains that will eventually merge. You might have heard this term on Twitter or elsewhere. And after that, Ethereum will become a proof of stake chain. For now, the proof of stake chain is essentially a test chain. When you put ETH into that chain, it doesn't come out until after the merge. And so
basically, just to say this back, like, Ethereum has technological limitations that lead to high gas fees, right? And there's a future state that is going to happen where there's going to be this merge, and basically it's going to be much more energy efficient, gas fee efficient, all of this stuff. And so what they did to get high yielding return for their constituents was they put it basically in this future state that they actually couldn't take it out of to generate high yield on those dollars. Is that fair?
Yeah, I don't mean to be pedantic, but the merge will not lower gas fees. It is really just meant to be a carbon footprint reduction, which is, you know, largely good, but that's really the main purpose, is carbon footprint reduction and lower security costs. But they essentially put the ETH in a place where they couldn't access it. They essentially put it into a safe and locked it up. Then, you know, starting about a week or two ago, people started being like, I'm seeing their wallets. These are on-chain sleuths. It was revealed that their on-chain activities could be discovered, right? There's no privacy on the blockchain. You can see what everyone's doing. And for a wallet as big as a multi-billion dollar custodial manager, you can kind of see what they're doing, not with all their funds, but with some of their funds.
They, in this case, is Celsius. You could see what Celsius was doing, and you could see where their assets resided.
So not all of the assets, because some of the assets were kept in cold storage. Some of the assets were kept on exchanges where it's obfuscated. But some of it, people saw, is kept in the ETH Beacon Chain. So it was being staked there, or was being swapped for ST ETH, which is a liquid staking derivative. But you might as well just say they took a bunch of user funds and put it in a place where they couldn't access it. Now, a couple of days ago, users started to really believe the uncertainty that was being spread on Twitter. The fear, uncertainty, and doubt, the FUD, and they started to withdraw funds. And then, of course, the CEO, Alex Mashinsky, and the leadership team went on a whole roadshow to be like, funds are safe, funds are safe, right? Like, don't withdraw. Like, that's what you need.
Clap back, in a hilarious twist, clack back at Mike Dudas, who was, said something about it, and the CEO actually yelled at Mike, saying, like, why are you spreading this FUD? Do you actually even know anyone that's had problems here? Because, and the problem is, in all of this, and this is true of a bank as well, but if people lose trust in the system, then it, you can have a run, and then you do have a liquidity problem, right?
Correct. And so they have this liquidity crisis where in the background, I'm making up a number here, but let's say they had $100 in deposits and only $50 of it was liquid. So you can't have more than 50% of people withdraw. And of course, you know, it sounds silly to say, no one's going to have a problem withdrawing until they have a problem withdrawing. The first 50 guys are going to be able to withdraw perfectly fine. The 51st guy is going to be like, where's my money? And they're going to be like, we don't have it for you.
Which is funny. That's kind of what the CEO, if you read back his message to Mike, it's like, Mike, do you know anyone that's had a problem withdrawing? And it's like, it's true until it isn't, right?
Mike should have been like, not yet. Call you back in like, I don't know, 24 hours.
And, exactly. So then on, I think it was Monday, or Sunday, they officially paused withdrawals because they were like, we're illiquid. We were running into a liquidity crisis. And then as of last night, they actually retained the GC's old restructuring law firm, Irony of Ironies, to come help them sort through what is almost certainly going to be a bankruptcy. And actually, I was up late last night talking to a law school professor from Georgetown, thinking through what this bankruptcy is going to look like because it's super bizarre. One of the other, let me just add a wrinkle, one of the really, really weird things that they did was not only, you know, did they do all this degenerate gambling with user funds, locking it up into like illiquid staking instruments. And I want to be clear, this is not a failure of the Ethereum network. This is not a failure of liquid staked ETH. This is not a failure of Lido protocol, which is one of their on-chain partners.
No, the protocols did exactly what they said they would.
They did exactly what they were supposed to do and continue to do what they were supposed to do. But the one other thing that they did is they went to permissionless lending markets. Okay. And now this is where crypto gets to be a double-edged sword. Because it's totally permissionless, anyone at any point can place collateral and pull a loan. You don't have to call a loan officer. You don't have to get approved. You don't have to have a credit rating. As long as you have the collateral, you get a loan. You get a loan, you get a loan, you get a loan. It's like Oprah, right? So they went there and they placed billions of dollars of user deposits and then borrowed stablecoins from it. Now, the way this collateralized lending works is you have to put more collateral than you have borrow, right? Just like when you go to a pawn shop, you put down your $10,000 Rolex and they give you like $100 for it. So you have to put $1.50 to get a dollar out. So they put $1.50 of user funds and got a dollar out. And then the collateral, which is volatile, it's like WBTC, it's ETH, it's as you know, crypto, it goes up and down. The crypto starts falling in value. Now, unlike a lender where you can call and you can say, hey, could I just get a 1 week extension on my interest payments? Could I please just, you know, cut a break? You know, I need to work some shit out. Like, you know me, Bob, we've been doing business for 20 years. The smart contract does not care. The smart contract is deterministic. And this is both a benefit and the curse, right? And so they were at risk of falling below their collateralization ratio, which would have wiped out all of the collateral they put in the system to start with. And so they did these two really awful things. Number one, they opened a huge lending position that they can't get out of. They can't call the bank. They can't, in a bankruptcy proceeding, convert that debt. They, you know, in a bankruptcy proceeding, you could say, hey, this was senior secured. I'm going to convert some of you to equity. You know, I'm going to take you out, you know, on this deal. You can't, there's no negotiation. There's no, you know, debtor in possession. There's no process. There's no court system. It's a smart contract and it executes 24/7, whether you have the money or not. So that's the first thing they did. And second thing is they locked their user funds in a super illiquid position that they can't get out for an indeterminate amount of time, at least a year. And so as of now, it just seems like they can't give anyone their money back. And we don't know the position in the background because they're not DeFi. We can't look on chain to see what their holdings are. It's all obfuscated. And it's ultimately in the hands of the CEO and the leadership team.
And now it's pulling down the market because explain the impact on this as it ripples through the system.
Do we know how much they've borrowed and from whom?
Yeah, a lot of that can be seen on chain. And so, again, it's not potentially all of their wallets, but some great reporters like from The Block and others have figured out what their wallets are. And so we have some sense, but it's in the hundreds of millions of borrow, you know. Yeah.
You know, there's your knock-on effects, I assume, right? Because if they're insolvent, that borrow is never getting paid back. And then there's got this like cascading effect that will
exactly
happen.
So the way the borrow protocol works is, again, they don't care. If you don't have enough collateral, they liquidate your collateral. And so imagine the lending protocol having $500 million of Bitcoin or wrapped Bitcoin, the Ethereum version, $500 million of Bitcoin, realizing, oh, you can't meet your obligations. I'm going to market dump $500 million of Bitcoin. And so the market is looking at this and being like, there's some risk that a gigantic whale, specifically this robot lending protocol, is going to dump $500 million of Bitcoin. Well, I'm going to bake that into the price of Bitcoin, right? I'm not going to just keep it at today. Clearly, Bitcoin is not worth dollar for dollar what it is worth today if there is some non-zero chance that 500 million of it is going to get sold tomorrow. And so that's, again, it's hard to decompose, like how much of it was the macro impact, how much of it was this, it's hard to decompose, but it's almost inarguable that it had some impact on prices.
It's like which Jenga piece knocked it over. I mean, it's all combined and you need them all to, it almost doesn't matter in a sense. Like it's kind of designed to your point, right? Because it is centralized, like it is kind of designed to just like collapse immediately. And there are no like unwind possibilities because it's all in the computer. Computer just does it based on the code. That's
the computer
it.
Just does it. So they combined kind of, and that's why Celsius is such a great use case or a case study. You combine the worst of all worlds. You combined a permissionless lending market, which in a totally transparent permissionless environment.
Which, by the way, John, at one point you said there's good and there's bad. And I'm still waiting to hear the good part of this because everything that came out of your mouth was bad.
And to be clear, I do think Celsius is bad, right? It's the combination of a bunch of opaque human actors who are hiding all their transactions and the ability to create a huge amount of unaudited leverage. And by the way, that liquidation, if and when it happens, will happen in an orderly manner. It's not going to blow anyone up. By definition, it's over-collateralized. If you think about the traditional finance space, right? I used to work in private equity. All loans are essentially unsecured. It's essentially based on faith and credit.
And like the enforcement of the U.S. court system and all of this downstream. Like,
yeah,
yes,
but there's no hard collateral for a corporate loan, right? Like if you're a CEO and you're like, hey, I've got this EBITDA, I've got this cash flow, you give me 10 times cash flow for debt, I can service it. And the bank basically says, you know, based on our risk assessment, based on your reputation, based on the cash flow, we think this might be okay. Yeah. And for them to recover, they have to go through this whole bankruptcy process, court system, and they might not get full recovery. Now, the great thing about crypto, this is truly one of the great things about crypto, is because it has to be deterministic and there's no human judgment, by definition, almost every loan on crypto is over-collateralized, way over-collateralized, which means it's highly capital inefficient, but it likely has less systemic risk built in because you don't get washed out and have nothing to pay it back. Of course, there's this like snowball effect
where you have to liquidate the collateral. You have a black swan event that happens way more frequently because there is no trust and those prices of the collateral do move in concert with what you lent to. Like they're all linked together. Everybody's model assumes these like assets are uncorrelated, but they're correlated.
No question. But MakerDAO, who's the robot lender in this question, isn't going to blow up. The bank isn't going to go away. The bailout's not going to happen.
Because it's over-collateralized.
Yeah, no, that is true. It's just the people who put their money with Celsius and...
Sure,
and,
you know. I mean, so were the people who put their money with Lehman and Bear and like, you know, and so I'm not saying Wall Street was better or worse. Like,
and Madoff.
A gigantic deleveraging, just it doesn't feel good for anyone when like assets go down and all
it's the just we're going to have like 100 Madoffs all at once and 20 Lehmans all at once and then they're going to keep... You know what it reminds me of? And like, this is all like... You know when we had this like anti-vax movement back with like Jenny McCarthy, it started in the 90s or something, she was concerned that like vaccines cause autism because she's stupid, and they don't. But like, and by the way, like, we don't even have to go up like even if they did, because I don't want to open that can of worms because they don't, and she's a moron. But like the reason why people are like, why do we need vaccines is because we had vaccines and they worked and like no one was getting polio and no one was getting measles and no one was getting mumps. And everyone's like, well, why do we use the vaccines? Nobody gets this stuff. And it's like, yeah, we don't get it because we have vaccines, you idiot. And then they go, well, maybe we won't do it. And guess what comes back? Measles and mumps and eventually polio. Yep. And like, this is financial regulation in crypto. People are like, why do we need these middlemen? Why do we need these courts? Why do we need these banks? And it's like, well, they're there because there were like a lot of scams over the last 150 years and you all lost a lot of money. But everybody's 26 and has never experienced this before and they're all going to get scammed. It's just like watching it in real time.
I think if people made it to the MakerDAO component of this, hopefully they don't think vaccines cause autism. Like I would hope it, like the listener group like, that we have.
Well, there's like a little crunchy component of this. Like, I don't know. There's like some overlap if I don't trust the government and I don't trust vaccines.
Add Zach Weinberg on Twitter. He would love to hear from you if you think autism is caused by vaccines. John, like, well, to Zach's question there, though, to what end? Like, so all this is happening and you said what do you think the good in this is, right? And you said earlier in the conversation that like a lot of these things are good because they're helping educate and snuff out the problems that exist in the world, right, with this system. And so obviously this itself is bad, but what is the end state that we get to? Are we just recreating everything that we have created in a digital world that's slightly different? Or what is the end state that we're moving towards that is worth the $26 billion in fraud that's already happened, the whatever billion dollars of economic destruction that we're going to go through to get here?
Yeah, pretty much, right? Pretty much. It's the counter case of what you're saying, Zach, is that if you think about 2008, there was like a vast expansion of the Fed's power. Like essentially the Fed was like, oh man, we really all this rules making, like the whole system that we've set up is like horribly overlevered. All of our systems of trust are broken, right? You know, Big Short, everything's AAA. And in fact, it was actually not, right? And that actually reeks of Celsius. Like this is all totally safe, but oh, actually not. We're actually selling subprime to like a ton of people who shouldn't have loans. And what we had to do was go on this 10-year QE money printing journey where if you think about what happened today, right? We raised by 75 basis points. Jerome Powell controls the economy. One man's whims, and his team, of course, and the scientists of the Fed control what happens to the Treasury.
How did we get from crypto scam to Fed? I'm missing the logical leap. Like, I agree. Jerome Powell has a lot of plot.
So the hubris of crypto, and it is hubris, right? Because these are all human things. Like even crypto, even though it's robots built by humans, is humans saying we can do better than J. Powell. We can do better than J. Powell. A community of engineers, scientists, academics.
That is not what they're saying. They can't print their own money. You can't use the money that they print. It has nothing to do with the Fed. It is absolutely nothing. If they're like, someone's like, hey, tomorrow I made this new blockchain coin or whatever, and then I go into Target and I'm like, hey, Target, can I get a piece of paper for this blockchain coin? And they're like, what are you talking about? That is not the same thing as the Fed printing dollars.
I thought we moved way past this bridge between digital and real world. I'm saying they have the hubris to think they can create a parallel economy. And by the way, they, including me, we think we can build a parallel economy that's better governed, that is safer. I shit you not. This is the hope.
A parallel, pure digital economy that runs exclusively in Mark Zuckerberg's metaverse, basically.
Not Mark Zuckerberg. Every single person in crypto hates Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah, me too. But like in the metaverse, metaverse.
Or on digital rails, right? On digital decentralized rails. And this is the hubris, right? This is the fundamental hubris. Now, if you look at this and you're like, y'all are cracked out. J. Powell knows what he's doing. The Treasury has always done right by us. I trust the U.S. government. Then, yeah, you have every right to be a crypto skeptic.
No, I just prioritize my physical life, like food and shelter and water and the electricity to run the computer to get on the internet, which is also run by a company.
And to be clear, I don't think it's a zero-sum game. I don't think it's crypto's going to replace your Subway sandwich, right? It's going to be 5% of your life. Mm-hmm. It's going to be 10% of your life. For your kids, it's going to be 80% of their lives, right? Your kids are going to be like, they're going to meet their partners and spouses like somewhere online.
Yeah, but
John, you think Zach sold Flatiron for $2 billion and he's eating at Subway? If there's some Subway, some high end Subway I don't know about, that might.
Give him some grace. You know, make him look like an everyman.
I sold it for $2 billion Bitcoin or something, and now I've lost it all in Celsius. And Logan, if Redpoint's hiring, I would like an associate job. That would be nice.
I think you have a career as a media personality, so I think that's your future end state. If this whole operator thing doesn't work out.
Strongly agree.
John, is the world that you talk about in this digital existence, like, and I wonder where venture fits into all of this, because to some extent, like venture in this world, in a lot of cases are acting as gatekeepers, right? And there's a lot of things that they're getting access to that lead to some level of centralization, I think. I don't know. But how big as a venture investor, and as we think about this digital world, like, I actually agree with all your use cases. I mean, I don't know if they can be practically applied, but like, I actually agree with, you know, this is all interesting stuff and I don't need to debate the merits of this or sick my attack dog, Zach, on the merits of this. But like, how big is all of this stuff? Like, do you think that this ends up being a $10 billion market, a $50 billion market? Like, how do you even think about the potential of this in 5, 15, 25 years?
I mean, I have a very hard time doing the TAM analysis, right? And I'll be honest, I always thought TAM was bullshit. Every time I saw that on a slide deck, I was like, you're just making some stuff up.
Yeah, totally.
But if we wanted to take a guess, right, what's the market cap of gold? It's like 15 trillion or something.
I just mean, how important will this be, I guess? I'm using TAM as an example, but I know Zach loves market cap of gold, so I'll let you go.
Sure,
there.
There's the market cap of gold. You could do that. You could do what's the market cap of coins today, or a couple months ago, it was like approaching $2 trillion. And you could say, oh, well, the $2 trillion, you know, DeFi penetration in that market was like a billion. So banking, if you think of DeFi as like the bank for crypto, like 99.9% of crypto is unbanked. Okay, that's a pretty strong long thesis on DeFi penetration. You can think about gaming. You can comp to like traditional gaming companies. League of Legends does $1 billion of, you know, sales of items in their game. There's like lots of ways to think about this, but I think the easiest way for me to conceive of it is if you have and pursue and want to transact economic value on digital rails, and that could be in a game, that could be e-commerce, that could be really anything that's purely digital, right? Purely digital goods, buying stickers on TikTok, tipping someone on OnlyFans, whatever it is, that is part of the TAM in my mind that crypto has a shot at taking.
But why does it like those people want dollars? Like, I just keep coming.
Do they? Yeah, like, literally, do they? Like, I mean, as of not that long ago, obviously we're in a bear market right now. It's very, very painful. But like, as of not that long ago, there was $2 trillion in market cap. So how is that not an argument that some people don't want this? Clearly, some people
want
this.
Well, because a lot of people bought really shitty mortgage-backed securities thinking it was one thing and it turned out to be another. Like, people speculate. I'm just saying at the end of the day, once the like, hey, this thing only goes up, goes away, which is hopefully where we are right now. At some point, people are like, hey, when I get paid as an OnlyFans person or as a business or an e-commerce company, and honestly, even as like the owner of the game, I kind of want to get dollars out of this at some point because like that's what I use day to day to do anything.
And that's something that we can't argue, right? It's like I'm saying people want crypto because I pointed the crypto market cap. You say people want dollars because you like eating Subway sandwiches. And you're an entrepreneur. I was once an entrepreneur. We're going to just have to see, right? We're just going to have to wait. And like, it's going to resolve itself, which one of us is correct. But like, I think plainly it's inarguable that people want this. Now, you might say, oh, they only want this because it's speculative. Okay. I don't know. I don't know what the reason is. I'm just saying that people seem to want this thing.
Yeah, but you could like reason through it, right? Like you have a sense of why you think they want. And there's probably a subset of like true religious believers, right?
And
like,
I would count really myself as one of those, right? As
yeah,
just,
yeah.
Like, I deeply believe in the technology and its ability to transform.
There's clearly a subset, I don't know what, of the Bitcoin or related holders who are just like, I don't want my money in fiat, period, ever, because they have enough money in fiat to be able to survive. And so they have what I would describe as a luxury of holding these digital coins that actually can't be translated over. But I just like, what if that holds at the end, you know, 5-6 years when people realize like, oh, right, I do need fiat at the end of this for anything that isn't purely digital. That's what scares me.
John, one thing that you kind of touched on here that I'm curious about is it seems like a lot of venture investors are investing in, like they actually don't view the equity in these businesses as meaningful, right? And like what they view as the upside are the tokens, and that's the innovation here, and that's what we really care about. And so when you see things like Celsius valued at $4 billion, right, who knows? You know, did they even care that much about what the equity of Celsius was worth instead of access to these tokens that potentially they got? I don't know the structure of this, but that's one of the narratives that I've heard. Is that, does that hold water with you, or is that a pump and dump on retail type front running that is just a good way in a upcycle where all this stuff is going on to make money and have when you have disproportionate access and influence?
I think VCs both get too much grief and not enough in the crypto space. The first thing is that they're an important source of capital and innovation, right? There's just no way we're going to be able to build all these things without a huge amount of high conviction dollars. And there's a lot of crazy VCs out there who believe me, and they're like, yeah, we're going to be driving, you know, dino trucks in the metaverse in 20 years, and my kids are going to be, you know, taking over leveraged loans on that stuff, right? And they're going to go bankrupt in the metaverse and their lives are going to be over. Like they believe in this shared vision of like, highly libertarian, you know, whatever, self-ownership, et cetera. Or they believe at least that people broadly in the world are going to want to adopt
those
technologies.
John, you know what they believe? They believe in management fees. That's what they believe in.
Hey, by the way,
let's be clear
the age
about
of the
believe.
Age of deploying high velocity capital is coming to a close. So we'll have to see. We'll have to see over the course of the next few years. But I think the question was kind of like equity token structures. You know, for better or worse, there's no standard, right? Sometimes the equity converts to a token. Sometimes in Uniswap's case, there's an equity entity, Uniswap Labs, and there's a decentralized protocol, which is, you know, equity, which is a Uniswap protocol. And the Labs component owns some of the tokens, but not all of it. And the token organization is controlled by a decentralized organization. And the Labs component is a normal VC-backed startup that builds services on top. There's no real answer. Sometimes the equity really is worth something. And it is a centralized entity and it's building centralized products. And that's okay. Centralized businesses are okay. Crypto people don't kill me for that, right? Web2 businesses are okay. And sometimes the equity converts and it becomes a token. And that's important. I think maybe what you're pointing at, maybe if I'm reading between the lines, is like the token seems to be worth more. Well, yeah, there's all types of tricks you can play in an unregulated environment where you can constrain the circulating liquidity. You can create all these recursive lending games. You can offer these huge staking yields. So of course, until there's self-policing or regulation or something that constrains the types of market activities that can be done with tokens, there's way more tricks you can play with pumping a token than you can with equity. That's just the truth.
That's actually one of the things when I hear people and VCs I've heard say, hey, we don't care about the equity, we care about the tokens, right? And
yeah.
when I hear that, maybe in some finite use cases, I can come up with why value might potentially accrue there versus somewhere else. But at the end of the day, it feels like, hey, this is an unregulated way for me to put my finger way on the scale in a way that wouldn't be possible with equity. And disproportionately create value because of the access and influence I have.
I don't think it's that nefarious. I don't think VCs are pump and dumpers for the most part, right? VCs don't want to see if they're long term minded, they don't want to see the industry go down in flames just as much as any of the builders do, right? If you want to be in business as a VC for like many, many funds and many, many years, then it behooves you to actually treat the industry nicely and the retailers and the owners and the participants and stakeholders in these networks nicely and fairly. That being said, though, I know if I take a business to IPO right now, it's going to be traded on a revenue or EBITDA multiple. If I take a token to the public, it's going to be traded on what's the framework, right? And so the upside really is kind of infinite because we don't have a Warren Buffett, Graham and Dodd-like valuation framework. There's no price to book. There's no EBITDA. There's no adjusted net income. It's just whatever the market thinks this thing is worth. And so a lot of these tokens trade on comparables, which is just like, well, compared to Ethereum, this is going to be 10% as big. That's just random. Nobody has science behind that. It's just like VCs underwrite this. Like, I think this thing could be like, you know, maybe 10% as big as Ethereum. All right, cut the check, you know?
Yeah, got it. And I realize the case could be made that the IPO process, you know, has similar, or Bill Gurley would make the case, the IPO process has similar incentive structures if you run a traditional IPO to get, you know, certain people involved, and that they should have long-term incentives. But I realize that this is, but that has tons of very long history and hasn't run up nearly as long. And these people have existed way, way longer in their reputation. So,
well, one other thing those companies have are business models and earnings and like a product that people pay for.
Zach, have you heard of a SPAC? Have you heard of a SPAC? This is a big thing that happened in the past couple of years. Have you heard of that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I understand. Like, even in our financial system today, with all the rules and regulations and however many chamoths are running around trying to skirt those rules, like, we still have frauds. And, you know, one of them might have been Chamath himself. And the problem with that is, like, we've actually done a lot of rule writing to kind of limit it to the SPACs. And we're saying, well, look, if there's fraud over there, like, it's cool over here. And I'm going, guys, like, the level of fraud that we can expect in a market with no rules relative to what we already get in this, like, pretty decently regulated market, and it has its problems and it doesn't work perfectly, is like, I don't know, 1,000x the fraud, like, it's pretty big. I got to think that the fraud is worth 100 times than the actual value created.
And this is where I take my job very seriously as an educator, because people need to know what they're getting themselves into. They need to know how Uniswap protocol works on a deep technical level. And if you don't understand how it works and the case in which you get fucked, guess what? Daddy's not here to protect you. This is the Wild West. This is what crypto is, right? And yeah, is there a lot of fraud? 100%. But you look at this bull cycle and we've got a couple truly incredible innovations like Uniswap and MakerDAO and Compound and Aave. And these are just
none of those things are incredible innovations. They're very cool technically. Like, they're cool. Just like SETI at home was like a really cool thing where we were searching for alien life using people's leftover computers. It was very
95.
Cool. Yeah. And like, I ran it on my laptop when I was a kid, and like, it was cool. It did actually do absolutely nothing, and we didn't find anything, and it accomplished zero, but it was like cool technology. And that's kind of what's going on here. It's like really cool technology searching for aliens that we're just not going to find.
Well, we're going to have to just see. We're going to have to wait. You know, we'll have to run this back in 10 years, 10 year anniversary of the Zach and John.
I have a feeling people might remind Zach of these clips if your world proves out. But John,
I mean, remind me too. Remind me too.
This is what's going to happen. In 2 years, we're going to find the alien. Actually, people are going to be like, look, we found the alien. The Bitcoin thing's going to work.
It worked.
You know?
Let me just finish off with the thematic response to what you're saying, which is, oh, what's the use case? This is it's going to sound like an excuse, but this is why I think people have a hard time wrapping their heads around crypto, because there is no conventional business model. There's no Warren Buffett like EBITDA and price to book and financial metric. That language of valuation and commercialization has not been developed. And so you can kind of think of it like all of us are building this thing that's like TCP/IP, you know, or it's SSL. And it's these like standards, open standards. Like, what's the value of those things, right?
I would say a lot and nothing would be what I would say.
Well, I just, like, I know it's funny because, it's hard to disagree with some of the things you're saying, even though, like, a few of them, I'm just like, I don't know how you're saying this and then thinking it's positive. But, like, what you said is we have crypto, which doesn't have, like, rational, normal ways of judging value in terms of, like, I don't know, revenue and earnings and, like, normal things like that. Fair. We also have like $90 billion of real normal human money, including like pensioners and, you know, teachers' funds or whatever, who are making their way into these businesses. And we're kind of saying like, yeah, we're not exactly sure how we're ever going to get any of that back on like normal metrics, but maybe we'll sell the coin usually. Like that's the part that just like my mind explodes, because there should be a link. If we're putting real people's money into these businesses, we should have some link to like cash back at some point. Isn't that the point of investing?
Who's we? If I'm not here to make an excuse about the Harvard endowment manager, if you're dumping a ton of stuff into a gigantic venture fund who can't explain to you how these things get valued on conventional metrics, and you wake up one day and you're like, guys, I'm really upset. These things don't have earnings, do they? That's your fault. Like, I'll be super clear. Like, I don't think we've invented the valuation language. And let's not forget, modern valuation was pretty much invented by Graham and Dodd, right? Like, we pretty much said there's something called cash and there's accounting and all these things existed in some kind of like real way. But the language of how they got valued, accounted, earnings multiples, and traded, that was all an invention by some academics that then became very widely adopted because they seemed to be predictive. It seemed to be predictive that if you buy a business at a low multiple, it eventually makes enough money to pay you back, right? That science does not exist. Capital N does not exist in crypto because every token's economics look a little bit different. So if we want to get to a world where we can value something in a standard way, then we need Warren Buffett, right? We need a Warren Buffett to come in here and be like, there are six prototypes of tokens. Here's how they accrue value. And here are the four metrics you want to look for. No one's done it. And Logan, I know you're a VC. Many VCs have tried. No one's done it yet.
You know who like did look at it though at one point? Warren Buffett. And then he was like, nah, that doesn't work. So,
well, that doesn't surprise me. That doesn't surprise me, right? Like, if you were the inventor of classical finance, you wouldn't look at a thing that rejects all of its principles and say, you know what? I'm going to spend a lot of time trying to figure this one out.
The whole thing reminds me of like, you know, when you talk to these, maybe you get to meet them, but you talk to these entrepreneurs and they're like, imagine a world. This is all the pitch. They always start like
yeah,
this.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Imagine a world. Where like you can go from point A to point B using just like a jetpack. Like, wouldn't that be awesome? It's like, well, yeah, that's like really hard to disagree with. That would be fucking awesome.
Yeah,
I would love to do that.
Yep.
And that's where most of the crypto analysis stops. And then it turns out like actually to go from point A to B, there's this like giant bird that shows up whose talons kind of like hold your head and they drop you 25% of the time. And sometimes you never make it there. And you're like, okay, that wasn't as good as how you described it with the whole like point A to point B thing. You forgot to leave out all the details where I die. And like, that to me is what's going on here. It's like, where are the details of how it actually like creates value?
And I think you're drawing a really salient analogy here, which it looks like early venture, right? It looks like, okay, just because these tokens are publicly traded doesn't mean they're early, right? If someone was like, hey, I've got a thing where, you know, you watch other people play video games, you'd be like, that sounds fucking dumb. You
no,
know?
It's not. No, it's not.
Oh,
I used to
but
watch...
at the time, I've got a thing
people
where you just get into a stranger's private car and, you know, they just take you down the block and you pay them to, here's another one. You're going to rent out a guy's living room. You're going to sleep on his couch.
For 1 second. The first one you described, people were literally, I mean, I remember watching my neighbor play Zelda when I was 12 years old. Now, I wasn't proud of it because, like, I wasn't playing and my mom would always be like, why do you like to watch this guy play video games? I couldn't really explain it, but, like, people did it. You know, we already saw it. And then the second one you described was, like, every taxi since, like, I don't know, the first century here. So, like, we've been getting into strangers' cars for a very long time. It doesn't seem that crazy. Now, sleeping on their floor, maybe a little weird, but we also go to hotels and a bunch of rooms where, like, we've just never been there and there's some, like, random person who cleans them. These are all things that, like, actually we kind of mostly did, maybe not in the exact way. That's the part that bothers me in all of it, which is, like, except for maybe some of your gaming examples, which are somewhat reasonable, the rest of them are, like, imagine a world. And there we are back to, the bird carrying you from point A to point B. And I'm like, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, I'm not trying to make excuses for how early the world looks in crypto, but I am trying to say all of these ideas look obvious in hindsight, but at the time they were incredibly contrarian bets. By the way, I'm not clear at all that Airbnb, Uber, DoorDash, all of these venture-backed Web2 innovations are actually sustainable businesses long-term either. Okay, so we could have just wasted a whole bunch of human energy.
Valid criticism.
Just jerking ourselves off.
Yeah.
Totally,
yeah.
Totally, right? Yeah. But at the time, even if we were to give them the grace of, like, these were innovative products, they looked kind of dumb, you know? And so there is this notion of just, like, you know, it's been parroted around Twitter all the time, but it's like some of this early stuff looks like a toy because we haven't figured it out yet. And it's doubly, triply, 100 times so when you got people on the internet being like, to your point, I'm going to change the world. Imagine a world in which, and you're like, I'm not seeing it. Because that's what it is. It's an early venture pitch.
I really like you, John. I have to say, I really do. Like, I, you're like one of the most rational human beings I've talked to. And you kind of, like, defend some of the, like, almost like religious belief type of things in a very rational way. And most people are like, yeah, but this and this. And you're like, no. This is how it will work. And you just have to believe that this is what the future state looks like. It's kind of refreshing, actually.
No, I appreciate it. It wasn't my goal. My goal is to tear your head off, but I'm glad we're friends now.
You're going to get dragged for not. It's not that you didn't defend your positions. It's that you didn't actually.
Oh, the crypto maxis are going to be all over me. They're going to tear me apart. You know,
no, I cornered you into too agreeable of a position with us.
Totally. Yeah. Totally.
I try and disarm you by telling you how much I like you first. That's why.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to edit this. So this is at the top and it seems like you just buttered him
up. I can't wait to see the one clip that gets me going viral.
Exactly.
Can't wait for that one.
It's
going to
be when you
one.
Said that CFO went to jail. That's going to be the clip. We already
that
told
was great,
you so.
By the way, and very subtle too. I love that.